It is Wednesday, March 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, an incident outside the British Parliament is being treated as a terror attack.
There is an ongoing investigation being led by the Counter-Terrorism Command, and we would ask anybody who has images or film of the incident to pass those to the police.
The United States and United Kingdom announced new restrictions on electronic equipment on passenger planes, and pop singer Lorde releases a new single. It's all ahead. The British Parliament building in London has been put on lockdown following reports of gunfire outside the building on Wednesday. London's ambulance service says this is a major incident, then at least a dozen people are injured. I'm joined now by Jamie Detmer, who's in the British capital. Jamie, what is known about this attack so far?
Well, it's an attack that appears to be by one assailant, although there is some reports still there may have been a second person involved. It came in three stages. A man driving an SUV over Westminster Bridge by the House of Commons mounted a sidewalk and struck up to a dozen people, two of whom I am told by medical staff at a nearby hospital have died. He then proceeded into Parliament Square, full of tourists and office workers, crashed the vehicle, hitting people as well, into the railings by Old Palace Yard, which is part of the House of Commons complex, got out of the vehicle, rushed past the barrier, was confronted by a policeman, who he then proceeded to stab. There were several shots fired by other police officers. The man is described as being middle-aged and Asian in appearance. The House of Commons was put into immediate lockdown. The Prime Minister was in a voting lobby by the chamber of the House of Commons, was surrounded by her bodyguards, plainclothes bodyguards, who drew weapons. One of the guards put his arm around her, hustled her out of the building. She was sped away in a silver limousine, followed by a Range Rover full of armed guards.
And what about other MPs?
Other MPs, lawmakers, no other injuries. But they're all in lockdown, as are journalists and as are people in the building, including a very senior British police officer, by the way, who had done a terrorist rehearsal just the day before on the River Thames, are all in lockdown. And at the moment, the building is being searched by counter-terror police and specialist units, a warren of rooms and chambers, to make sure no one else is in the building. And I said, we do know that two people have so far died. There is a report that there is a body floating face down in the River Thames, presumably one of the people on Westminster Bridge who either jumped or was pushed over the parapet into the water by the SUV.
And there's very tight security normally at the Houses of Parliament.
Yes, there is. And it was tightened up at the last major incident, which is in 1979, when Airey Neave, a confidant of Margaret Thatcher, was blown up by the IRA in a car bombing inside the House of Commons. They managed to get a bomb into the car, in the parking lot, which is an underground parking lot, and all security was changed. And I suspect that this incident will prompt a massive rethink of security around the building, and it wouldn't surprise me if the upshot of that is a Parliament Square, that huge square between Westminster Cathedral and the House of Commons, Westminster Abbey and the House of Commons, is closed to traffic, even possibly pedestrian traffic as well. This is the worst incident, really, terrorism-wise, in the UK since May 2013, when there was a killing of an off-duty British Army officer, a soldier rather, who was hacked to death on a London street. And the intelligence services really thought they had contained the terrorist threat in the UK. But this just goes to show all you need is a car and a knife, low-tech terrorism, very hard to prevent.
Mm-hmm. But what about the impact on the city itself? Because if you look at what happened in Paris in November 2015, there were coordinated attacks in different parts of the city. I mean, I'm sure police are in London are a bit worried potentially about that.
Yes, and we've just had a statement from Commander BJ Harrington, a spokesman for the Metropolitan Police, saying that additional armed police and unarmed police will be on duty throughout the day in London, particularly to protect any commuters leaving London back to their homes. And obviously, this is at the back of their mind. Is this part of any coordinated attack will there be other incidents in the capital today? But at the moment, it does look like a lone wolf attack. Mm-hmm.
And now this took place on the one-year anniversary of the attack in Brussels that killed 32 people. Mm-hmm. Do authorities think there's any connection or significance?
Well, they haven't suggested any. I mean, anniversary is interesting. This may, of course, be linked more to the electronic gadgets ban, which, in fact, ironically, a British minister was just explaining in the House of Commons about half an hour before this incident today. So it's unclear what provoked this attack, now, although, of course, the British police and intelligence services will be scrambling to find out as much as they can about this man, how he was radicalized, if it is a jihadist attack, and if there was any coordination or other people aiding and abetting.
All right. Well, my thanks to Jamie Detmer in London. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's the reaction to this on social media?
Well, we're seeing reaction from all corners of the globe on social media with terms like Westminster, Parliament, House of Commons all trending. And interestingly, not just London, but Londres, which are in French and Spanish. So we're seeing really global response to this. There is also a lot of speculation regarding the motive behind this. You just mentioned that the Brussels attacks occurred 1 year ago today. There's a lot of coincidence being speculated about that anniversary. But social media is also being used as a useful tool. We're seeing people put up images and videos from the moments right at the attack and right after the attack. And those will be used by investigators going forward to try to figure out what exactly happened. They'll interview people and ask them, but interviews sometimes get clouded in the adrenaline of what goes on. So these videos will be very critical. And then even now, as things are still developing, we're seeing the London mayor and the London Metropolitan Police using social media, particularly Twitter, to send out updates on road closures, on different elements, trying to find loved ones, things like that. To that end, Facebook has activated their safety check feature, which allows people to check in if they're in the area and they can signify that they're safe. And it allows people to look at their list of friends who might be in the area. So I've actually gone on Facebook and I've seen that there are a number of my friends who either live in London or were visiting London. And you can look and see who's marked themselves as safe and who hasn't done that yet. So social media being used not just for the speculation and to put these images up, but as a valuable tool to try to connect people and send out information.
And certainly to ease people's fears.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. An official says at least 25 people have starved to death in Somaliland. Sanctioned and shunned, North Korea finds arms deals in Africa. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says an anti-Islamic State coalition is united in stopping the terror group. And the ex-Trump campaign chief, Paul Manafort, earns millions from a Russian aluminum magnate. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Back in 2006, the International Astronomical Union, an organization recognized as the authority for naming celestial bodies, demoted Pluto from planet to a new category called a dwarf planet. The demotion was part of the organization's efforts to redefine the definition of a planet. Not everyone was happy with the decision to downgrade Pluto. Spirited debate on the subject continues between astronomers more than a decade later. Kirby Runyon, a doctoral candidate at Johns Hopkins University, counts himself as one who still considers Pluto a full-fledged planet. Runyon and a group of colleagues are trying to reinstate Pluto and describe others as planets by again redefining what makes a planet. Their suggested definition focuses more on the basic qualities of the body itself rather than current factors such as its orbit or other objects around it. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, singer Lorde's new release, Green Light, will be on the show just a bit later. The United States has announced new restrictions on electronic devices in the main cabin of passenger planes, having direct flights from several Middle Eastern and African airports to the U.S. It followed reports that militants want to smuggle explosives inside electronic devices. The airports include Cairo, Istanbul, Kuwait City, Doha, Casablanca, Amman, Riyadh, Jeddah, Dubai, and Abu Dhabi. Carriers such as Royal Jordanian Airlines, Egypt Air, Turkish Airlines, Saudi Arabian Airlines, Kuwait Airways, Royal Air Maroc, Qatar Airways, Emirates, and Etihad Airways have until Friday to comply. Britain said its restrictions apply to direct flights from Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, Tunisia, and Saudi Arabia. Terrorism analyst Greg Barton of Australia's Deakin University tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the new restrictions may also be in response to recent efforts to blow planes out of the sky.
Look, it seems to be linked, obviously, in the first instance, to the laptop-encased device used in Somalia that blew a hole in the side of the aircraft, killed the bomber, but didn't bring the aircraft down, fortunately, but presumably also linked to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and its series of attempts for attacks, including the Richard Reid shoe bomber attack, the 2009 flight into Detroit, in which a young Nigerian, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, had a device packed around his upper thigh, a so-called underwear bomb. And then, of course, 2010, we had quite large devices placed inside printer toner cartridges on cargo flights. One flight was brought down and other flights were detected. This was the work of AQAP. AQAP has a very clever bomb maker, Hassan al-Asiri, and he's been using a chemical called PETN, which is used in military-grade plastic explosives like Syntex. It's a very powerful explosive, and in a concentrated form, you could hold enough of it in the palm of your hand to bring down an aircraft, provided you did it at the right altitude and you detonated the device near the fuselage skin.
The airports covered include Cairo, Istanbul, Kuwait City, Doha, Qatar, Casablanca, Morocco, Amman, Jordan, Riyadh, Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, Dubai, and Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. Passengers are not going to be happy.
Because this includes not just laptops, but also even things as small as Kindle e-readers and the like. It also includes cameras. And, of course, a lot of tourists travel with expensive cameras that they don't want to put in a luggage hold. A lot of business travelers want to use their laptops to work on long flights. The airports the ban applies to sort of fall into two categories. One are airports in the Middle East and North Africa that arguably are not as secure as some of the best airports in the world. The others are airports in the same region, in Abu Dhabi, in Dubai, and in Qatar, that are regarded as very modern, secure airports, but very high volume, enormous volumes of passengers hubbing through the Gulf carriers, through those central hubs going onto Europe and onto North America. So it would have seemed that there's specific intelligence that's come through, and the analysis suggests that there's a sufficient threat that America and the UK have gone with this ban. Canada's considering it. Australia so far has said it's not going to go with the ban. But they're clearly concerned about airports that are regarded as not being up to scratch on security, and other airports that are, whilst very good, just dealing with massive flows of passengers coming through. And presumably the intelligence that triggered all of this is linked to AQAP in Yemen, and it may have come out of that rather disastrous raid that killed a US soldier, but nevertheless was said to have yielded valuable intelligence.
That's Greg Barton of Deakin University. He said terrorists can circumvent the new restrictions by targeting a plane's cargo hold. Well, as we heard earlier in the program, 1 year ago, terrorists killed 32 people and wounded more than 300 in Belgium's capital city. Those who lost a loved one during the attack share how they are trying to turn their mourning into something positive. Marta van der Wolf reports for VOA from Brussels.
Photos by Johan van der Steen are on display in Brussels. He was among those killed in terrorist attacks that rocked the city 1 year ago. His life partner, Kristen Verellen, organized the photo exhibit as a tribute to him.
Well, it has been a tough year, the 22nd of March. It's only a day of the year, but I think it's important that we as human beings are also capable to stand still and to reflect on the unhappy things in life.
For Ellen established a citizens' movement called Circles, We Have the Choice. connecting anyone affected by violence by sharing stories.
We have the choice, started immediately afterwards, to create a meaningful togetherness as a positive response to light violence and to the fragmentation and the polarization that we see in our society.
Some of the terrorists lived in the Molenbeek neighborhood of Brussels. Many of the 100,000 Muslims living here feel stigmatized. Some were also victimized. Mohamed El Bashiri is a metro driver from Molenbeek. His wife, Lubna, was killed when terrorists bombed the metro she was in, leaving him behind with their three young children. El Bashiri put his sorrow into a call for love by publishing a poetry book called Jihad of Love.
C'est un message d'amour.
It's a message of love, of humanity, a call for reflection. And it's related because the unimaginable, the unspeakable happened to me. And I think this is somehow a response. We need to express ourselves. We need love. And at the same time, we need to talk about what we are first and foremost, human beings. We need to return to our humanity.
It's here at the Maalbeek metro station where both for Ellen and El Bashiri lost their loved ones. Instead of a moment of silence to remember the victims, metro staff will observe a minute of noise, demonstrating their solidarity against hate and terror. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Brussels.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. A music star who hails from New Zealand has just released a new single. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins me with the details.
Today we're talking about new music that's been about 3 years in the making from a singer who's known as Lord. She is back, and her new album, Melodrama, is scheduled to be released in June. Of course, everybody knows her as being one of Taylor Swift's very best friends and in Taylor Swift's girl squad, and she also has been known for the hits that she released off the first album, Pure Heroine, which was 3 years ago. And she had hits like Royals, which a lot of people believed to be inspired by the royal family. She said, no, that's not the case at all. It's as simple as I saw a photo of a Kansas City Royals baseball player named George Brett. And the jersey said Royals, and she said, that's a good name for a song. So that's what inspired that. And then she followed that up with Team. So she seems like she's sports-minded, but in fact she's not. But she's got a brand new song. It's the first one off the upcoming album, and we're going to check it out today. It's called Green Light.
But I hear sounds in my mind. Brand new sounds in my mind. But only I.
Okay, now she also gave a very well-received performance about a year ago at the Brit Awards in tribute to the late David Bowie.
Yes, yes. She's a very good performer, although kind of there's not a lot of special effects that go on with Lorde. She's very much a one-woman act. She stands there in the center of the stage. There's no dancing other than her gyrations, which she's come under fire for. In fact, she was on Saturday Night Live a couple of weekends ago as the musical guest. She debuted her song, which we just heard. her green light. And there were some haters on the internet who had nasty things to say, to which she responded with, maybe the day will come when I have a professional choreographer put together a dance routine for me. She said, but that day is not here yet. So she's just, you know, she's into her music. You can see it when you watch her facial expressions during her performances. She's kind of now owned this new thing in music that she calls the claw. And if you watch her when she's up there, she puts her hand in this kind of a claw-like shape, and that's kind of how she does her thing when she sings. Very intense, and I always enjoyed her music. She's very unique. She comes from New Zealand and now lives in Los Angeles, and as I mentioned, she's been writing and working on the new album for a while. A lot of people have been asking for new music, so she's answered, and the new album, Melodrama, comes out in June.
All right, thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. The music of Lord, Green Light. Well, that's our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Human rights abuses continue to be a serious problem in Russia, according to the latest State Department Human Rights Report. The continuing occupation and so-called annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula affects the human rights situation significantly and negatively. The Russian government continued to train, equip, and supply pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, who were joined by numerous fighters from Russia. Credible observers attributed thousands of civilian deaths and injuries as well as widespread abuses to Russian-backed separatists in Ukraine's Donbas region and to Russian occupation authorities in Crimea. Russian authorities also conducted politically motivated arrests, detentions, and trials of Ukrainian citizens in Russia, many of whom claimed to have been tortured. Human rights groups asserted that numerous Ukrainian citizens remained in Russia as political prisoners. Within Russia itself, authorities restricted citizens' ability to choose their government through free and fair elections, and increasingly instituted a range of measures to suppress dissent. The government of President Vladimir Putin passed repressive laws and selectively employed existing ones to harass, discredit, prosecute, imprison, detain, fine, and suppress individuals and organizations critical of the government. Amendments to anti-terrorism laws granted Russian authorities additional powers that were also used to suppress and harass activists and critics of Mr. Putin's policies. Authorities especially targeted individuals and organizations that profess support for the government of Ukraine or oppose the Russian government's activities in Ukraine. The Russian government continued to target civil society. According to the Human Rights Report, authorities further stymied the work of non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, through the Foreign Agents and Undesirable Foreign Organization laws. Authorities also significantly expanded the definition of political activities to bring more NGOs under the foreign agents category. Authorities began fining NGOs for not disclosing foreign agent status, while courts closed NGOs for violations involving the foreign agents list. Under the expanded definition of political activities, authorities added environmental and HIV prevention organizations to the list. Promoting human rights and democratic governance is a core element of U.S. foreign policy, said U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. The human rights reports demonstrate the United States' unwavering commitment to advancing liberty, human dignity, and global prosperity around the world, including in Russia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.